Welcome back, everybody, to the Gaming Careers Podcast and episode 70. We're going to be covering four of the main platforms this week: Twitter, YouTube, Kick.com, and Twitch, and all of the updates that we've seen from the platform over the last couple of weeks. We'll be discussing Twitter's changes to longer tweets, now up to 4,000 characters, the removal of text two-factor authentication. YouTube side of things, we're discussing the replying to comments with shorts and Susan stepping down as CEO.
Over on the Kick side, which is the controversial new platform this year, Pete, we've got some big creators from Twitch moving over and YouTube potentially. We've got some updates on Twitch as well in terms of a lot of new features coming out. Some bad press Twitch has had in terms of view counts not being so accurate. TwitchCon 2023 dates and a whole lot more. But first things first, we got to talk about how you can write novels on Twitter now. Long tweets got announced, which I think had been teased for a while. But back on February 8th, they launched a new feature to be able to send out longer tweets up to 4,000 characters, Pete, on Twitter now. It's still, if you make a long tweet, it'll still go up to 280 characters and then have a little read more button at the end of it. Then you can expand the tweet to see the full thing. Like here, if you can see the screenshot, for those of you who are watching, quite a long tweet from Twitter Blue explaining all the details here. And I've seen a fair amount of these so far, Pete. I don't know if you've seen any kind of browsing Twitter yourself.
I haven't, but I think when you browse Twitter, right, it still just shows the first 208, is it 280 characters? And then there's like a read more or show more link, right? And yep. Then that takes you to this. I'm just looking at the stream now. This doesn't look like Twitter anymore. All of a sudden, seeing so much text on a page, it looks like, I don't know, it looks like some knockoff Twitter, Mastodon or whatever it's called. But yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it loads, but I also haven't spent a lot of time on Twitter. What are people using this for that you're seeing?
I mean, I feel like this was really inspired by Twitlonger, right? Like you said, that's what the general use has been in the past for longer things. Usually, honestly, the way I've seen it most of the time is not huge novels like this. It's often just to go a little bit over the cap if they can't quite fit the whole tweet into one thing, which is kind of nice if I've had many times where I have to kind of cut things out and try and fit it into that cap or do a thread sort of, when really it could just be one slightly longer tweet. So I guess that piece is nice. Again, I think this is kind of niche, and the reactions to this have been kind of mixed because Twitter's whole thing has kind of been to have the short takes versus, you know, Facebook or Tumblr or wherever you want to go to have longer blog or description type posts. But kind of interesting. I think it is only for Twitter Blue subscribers right now in the US, just to clarify. But I imagine it's coming to the rest of the world pretty soon.
It's working for me over here in the UK. Obviously, still Twitter Blue subscriber. But I think, yeah, since the announcement tweet, which was just over a week ago, we now have access to it over here in the UK. So I'm not quite sure how far through that rollout is. I don't think it's a massive feature. I think like it's one of those things where maybe people are going to use it instead of threads, but people like the engagement of threads and like being able to retweet specific parts of a thread. So who knows? But yeah, plenty of changes. It feels like Twitter is the one that's pushing out the most changes, which isn't surprising considering it's Elon at the helm. But we do have a couple of other little bits. This was probably the worst announced feature that I've seen so far this year, or how not to announce a feature. And this actually wasn't the announcement tweet. I can't find it now, or how they actually announced it. But I think this was this morning? No, a couple of days ago, about the removal of two-factor authentication, or specifically the SMS version of two-factor authentication. So let's just break this down for the audio listeners. What the actual news is that Twitter is removing SMS two-factor authentication for every account that isn't Twitter Blue. And the main reason for that is because it's costing them a lot of money, because there are these companies out there that charge for SMSs to be sent, and they're abusing Twitter on that. And I've got another tweet to show later, but it was in the realm of $60 million per year Twitter was paying for these, like, I don't know what they would refer to them as, but mobile companies who are trolling them for the charge of an SMS. But aside from that, two-factor authentication, it's highly encouraged. I would enable it on Twitch and any platforms that you care about, or any accounts that have any kind of financial details. But the SMS version is the least secure, because people can basically call up your mobile provider and be able to change your number to a different SIM card anyway. There's like there's various different levels of security. So the SMS version of two-factor authentication is usually not recommended. People prefer to use, you know, the Authy apps or the Google Authenticator apps, things like that are seen as more secure. Why Twitter didn't just come out and say, we're disabling SMS two-factor authentication and you need to use one of these apps because it's more secure. That would make so much more sense rather than keeping it for Twitter Blue. It makes it seem like two-factor was only going to be enabled for people that are paying for Twitter Blue, which is why so many people kicked off about this. I've probably jumbled my words in explaining that, but hopefully that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, I've always used like Google Authenticator or Authy type apps anyway for any kind of two-factor authentication. So this doesn't actually affect me, but I saw so many people crying about it that I wanted to try and explain a little bit as to why Twitter are doing it. Because a $60 million problem, even for a big company, is one that you probably want to get rid of.
Yeah, I saw what you linked there too about Elon kind of talking about the fact that basically these scam telecoms are coming up and putting out a bunch of fake texts just get Twitter to pay them a bunch of money. And their fraud was kind of going crazy from what he's told us, at least. So from that reason, it makes sense they'd want to cut back on this. It is weird, to your point, Pete, the execution of this was kind of strange because I think they didn't actually put an official statement out about it. People just start getting notifications on their phones that said, you have to turn off 2FA unless you pay, basically, which is not a great first reaction to see when you kind of log into Twitter. But turns out what they're trying to do is put it only on the Twitter Blue and really seems like to discourage the use of text SMS for 2FA at all. Now, there's a weird question of why is it still enabled for Twitter Blue? Is it just because they want to have something new to add to that tier? Because to your point, I mean, even for Twitter Blue users, it's not like they're somehow more safe than the average user, to my understanding. I mean, even Twitter Blue users can have the SMS stuff abused. So I'm not sure why they kept that. Maybe it's just some way to add an extra perk there. I don't know. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know either. It would have made more sense to me if they just removed the SMS to 2FA from everything, but they haven't done that. I guess maybe it's in their head they're justifying it as because they're getting money for Twitter Blue, then they can offset the cost of the SMSs that they're sending out. But yeah, it doesn't really make too much sense. I will leave a link down in the description below this video once we finish the live stream, as well as for the podcast audio, links to some of these tweets, because there was a Twitter Space recording tweet that you should listen to where Elon actually explains exactly you know, the magnitude of these scam SMS things that's costing Twitter $60 million. Yeah, and it's quite interesting to listen to because I hadn't really heard about that. And there's also a blog post from Twitter where they kind of break down exactly why they've had to do this. God, this is a white page and I haven't zoomed in on it at all, but you get the idea. But Twitter must be doing something right, because Meta, Facebook, Instagram, you know, they're all under the Meta brand now, have copied one of their recent features, which is pay to get verified. Ben, this is going to become something that we see on Twitch as well?
Yeah, I actually made a tweet about that this morning saying that, you know, Meta's doing it now, so it's coming to Facebook and Instagram, and then soon it's going to be pay $8 a month to become a Twitch partner and YouTube partner, right? And it's going to go to every platform. Because, I mean, it's worked to a degree. I've definitely seen a fair number of users on Twitter paying for Twitter Blue. I've tried it just out of curiosity. So it's definitely making them more money. And if Meta's looking at what Twitter's doing and saying, we can do that too, and just have a new revenue stream, then I get that. I do feel like this is going to start to dilute the importance of their verification badge. Even on Twitter, I think already it's kind of less exciting to see a verified account anymore. And if they kind of use the same pay for verification strategy on every platform, then I feel like people aren't really going to care about being verified anymore, because it's really just a mark if you paid for it. So we'll see. The details for this are, it's going to be $12 a month if you're on web, or $15 on iOS and Android, I guess, to actually share with the App Store. Usually that's why it's more expensive. But the way you verify will be having, you'll have to present a government issued ID to get verified. And I guess this is both for Facebook and Instagram from what I see. So that's different from what you do on Twitter, where you just have to kind of submit your payment info from what I understand. So maybe that'll cut down things, and it's only in New Zealand and Australia for now, but they want to roll out to everyone pretty soon. I don't know, Pete. I feel like they'll make an initial amount of money off of this, but it won't really last. That's my guess. But what do you think?
Yeah, it's a really confusing one, because it would have been so easy to laugh at Twitter's business model if it had failed, and maybe it still will fail. But the fact that Facebook or Facebook and Instagram now are also going to this sort of subscription-based model to get verified. It's a strange one. It doesn't even remove ads. That's the weirdest thing. It's not like you're paying for YouTube Premium and you no longer see ads anywhere. You're like you're literally just paying to get a verified checkmark, and then maybe there's some additional reach that you get for your account so that more people see your content. So yeah, it's a worrying trend to be honest, because if it works, all of the tech companies are probably going to band together and all charge $12.99 yeah. to get a verified checkmark.
I feel like we might actually see more of it for sure, because there's a lot of platforms that have verification in some method, and it seems like, again, my thought is this will make the platforms an initial amount of money, and then people will kind of lose interest and stop paying for it. But it's also going to damage the whole verification system overall. So I don't know. I feel like it's a very short-sighted decision myself, and I think we'll see less verified accounts overall down the line. Or maybe they just go back to what they used to do eventually if people stop paying for it. So we'll have to kind of keep an eye on it. But maybe come to Twitch and YouTube soon, Pete. You never know.
Well, let's transition into talking about YouTube. What a segue that is. Some new updates that we've seen in terms of Shorts. We've obviously covered Shorts quite a lot in the podcast this year because it's been an interesting feature update, and with monetization coming as well. But you can now reply to comments with a Short. So this effectively means that, can you remember the good old days of YouTube? This is like way, way back, where you could make video replies to other videos, and there would be like there'd be a little carousel below a video where you could see like 5 or 6 video replies. And that was a legitimate way to grow your YouTube channel, was to make video replies to the big channels, sort of reacting to their content or answering a question or something like that. Sounds like this is almost a throwback to that, but through short form video. So yeah, you can record yourself a little 60-second reply to a comment. And the comments don't even just have to be for comments on Shorts. These can be comments on full long form videos as well. So it feels like that feature's kind of coming back in some way. What are your thoughts on this, Ben? Is this something that you see being a useful feature? Is it going to increase the amount of people making Shorts, or is it just going to, you know, they're just trying to tie the two platforms together in some way?
Yeah, I think this is just trying to replicate more features that TikTok has, because this is a big part of TikTok. If you go through videos, there are a lot of creators who will reply to a comment with another video. So I think this is just them trying to replicate that on YouTube Shorts. Now, it is interesting that you can do that on comments for VODs, so your traditional, you know, 16:9 video. We'll kind of see if that gets more use. I can imagine it really will. Maybe some people will try it out. But yeah, I see a lot of this on TikTok, so I imagine they just want to kind of support that so that it is more of that one-to-one experience. And I think that trend will continue of platforms just taking ideas from each other that obviously work pretty well.
Yeah, and just to add, there is a YouTube Help article here that explains it in a little bit more detail. One thing to note is that when you make a short replying to a comment, there will be a comment sticker that you can add to your short to sort of show what you're replying to. And that comment sticker will also be tappable, so viewers can then watch the original content that the comment was left on. So if somebody writes a comment on a long form video and you reply with a short to that comment, you'll have a little sticker. Clicking that sticker will take you to the long form content. So maybe it'll be sort of a way that you can promote. I'm trying to think of like the full workflow here. If you made a long form video that you're really proud of, and then you react to a load of comments through Shorts, then you can effectively promote your long form video more to people that, you know, maybe are picking up more of your Shorts in the algorithm or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think there is like some ecosystem there, and they're probably tweaking with a lot of the controls to make sure it's not broken. But like, I don't know if you ever watched the Spiffing Brits YouTube channel where he tries to like find all these ways to abuse YouTube growth. I feel like this is going to be one way you can basically make thousands of Shorts for a video and then link to it, and then maybe it'll help grow it in the algorithm.
Just really quick, this what you just mentioned is also part of TikTok for sure. There's actually, what happens a lot on TikTok is standalone videos you can see that they're replying to somebody in the actual video. So in the video, it'll have like reply from this comment. And so people watch that video, which just kind of goes viral on its own, and then go watch the original video that spawned the comment. So it's actually a good way to kind of daisy chain videos together in a way. And I think that's what YouTube is seeing there as well.
Well, let's go on to talking about the big news in YouTube as of this week or last week, is that the CEO, Susan, is stepping down. And I didn't even know this actually before the article came out, but she's been at Google, who obviously owned YouTube, for 25 years. I think she was employee number 15 or 16 or something like that. There was an article that I was reading earlier that basically said when the two founders of Google were starting out, one of their first ever offices was Susan's garage or Susan's basement or something like that. So
yep.
She was right there at the very beginning, has been at Google and then at YouTube for the past 25 years, but she's stepping it down. I've seen mixed reactions to this, as you'd expect from the internet. You see people that are like, great, Susan was the devil. She, you know, made all these horrible changes. YouTube died under her reign. But you've also seen maybe some more thoughtful takes of that's a great person who clearly cared a lot about creators. You know, we saw Susan do a sit-down podcast with Ludwig. Like, you don't get that on other platforms. Well, maybe Elon would do it now. I don't know. But you don't typically see somebody in such an important role at a huge platform sit down and openly answer questions about, I think his podcast was about like the removal of dislikes and some of the controversies going on at YouTube back then. But in my opinion, I think it will be a loss. I think YouTube has been really well run and kind of similar to when we lost Ryan from the live streaming gaming side of YouTube. It's nice just to have that focal point of somebody that clearly cares and announces a lot of the news. So we do have some info about who's coming in. Ben, what can you share about that?
Yeah, so the replacement is going to be Neil Mohan. Hopefully I said his last name right. Who's the chief product officer and is going to be the new head of YouTube. He actually has been pretty active already in YouTube. So a couple things that he did that were notable were he helped, if you guys remember Ludwig's chess boxing event that he did pretty recently, that had multi-language support. So you could watch the live stream and listen to it in, I think, like English, Spanish, and maybe another language or two. And that tool was built by Neil. So it's good to hear that he's kind of got some interest in live streaming. I think you have here, Pete, worked on YouTube TV, YouTube Music, Premium, and Shorts. So definitely beyond just live streaming, he has a wide experience with all kind of the partnership and kind of YouTube Plus aspects of the business, which is really good. And it seems to be pretty confident that he can kind of pick up the job. I know he has been somewhat active on Twitter. To your point, Pete, one thing I've loved about YouTube figureheads is they've been very active in kind of being a face for the brand, especially compared to Twitch, because we really don't have much of that for Twitch, especially at the very top with Emmett Shear. So Susan was kind of the opposite of that, who was very active, was on podcasts, like you said, and was constantly talking about the brand. So I hope that Neil is the same way and we get more of that communication and kind of someone who kind of gets it and is talking about the brand a lot, because if not, that's going to be a huge loss. And I am kind of concerned that we've had a lot of people move away from YouTube in that role recently, just like you said. So hopefully Neil is pretty active going forward here.
Yeah, and we've seen details of the roadmap for YouTube for this year as well. They basically got three or four different products now, if you take Shorts, Live, and VOD format. It's a big platform and loads of engineers are going to be working on it to improve it and try and make it as competitive as an offering. I mean, it dominates the video on demand space, but for, in terms of vertical video and in terms of live streaming, I would say it's a competitor with you know, TikTok and Twitch and all those different platforms. So there's plenty of work to be done. I just really hope that we get somebody that cares about the creators, because I think that's just such a key part, seeing somebody that either has been a creator in the past or somebody that really seems to understand that side of the story to make the decisions. I'm sure that the person stepping in, what do you say his name was, Neil or something?
Yep, Neil.
Has been at YouTube for a while and worked on, like I said, or like you said, YouTube Music, YouTube Premium, and Shorts. I think most recently he's been working on Shorts, so I wonder if he'll have a bias towards that, if we'll see some shift in the algorithm that really pushes a lot of Shorts. But I'm sure Google have assigned the right person. So fingers crossed that they make the right decisions. I think that's it for YouTube news. So Ben, again, your magic ball. Do you want to do kick.com or Twitch next? Maybe we save Twitch for the end because that's what most viewers care about. But kick.com actually releasing a fair bit of news. Well, is it actually them releasing it or is it Trainwreck who seems to sort of be the figurehead? Let's start by talking about some big streamers that are apparently moving over to kick.com, and they're all sort of in the same group, aren't they? I don't have a term for these sort of live stream fail based streamers. Aiden Ross, Kai Sennett, iShowSpeed. You know, they appeal to a young, mostly young male audience, and there's rumors of all three of them moving across to Kick. And I don't know how true those rumors are, because I think it all came from Aiden Ross's stream. He certainly has shown some opinion about moving across to kick.com. But you know, this is a pretty substantial amount of Twitch's audience that we'll be moving over. I can't imagine many people listening to this podcast are, you know, avid viewers, but you know, I won't judge if you are. But if kick.com can start to sign big streamers, could it become a major player, Ben? I mean, we've been hesitant to think that it can be, but there's enough good news this week that if it went that way, you wouldn't be too surprised.
Yeah, I mean, if this is true, so Aiden, to my understanding, has moved over. Now, to be clear, I don't know a ton about these streamers in terms of watching them, but they are huge streamers that are kind of on this short list. So Aiden has been very huge on Twitch for a while, has streamed over there a couple times. I know that he's talked to Kai, that's one of the streamers that's called out here as well. And those two alone pull a huge amount of viewership on Twitch right now, Pete. I think Kai, he's currently streaming to 130,000 people on Twitch. So that plus what Aiden pulls would be massive. And then I know he mentioned Speed as well, who I think is one of the top YouTube streamers. I know he's always in the kind of the year in review things we talk about in terms of top YouTube streamers. So I think there's a chance here. Now, there's a lot of questions we talked about in the past about, like, is Kick a real viable platform? It's kind of funded by stake and very heavy into gambling, which I know some of you in chat are talking about as well. But at a certain point, I mean, if you get enough viewership coming to the platform, then it could become compelling. And it reminds me a little bit of like the Mixer situation way back in the day, Pete, where we had like two really big people move over and that wasn't enough to really make the platform viable. But if you have four or five top people moving over and their own kind of community going in there, then maybe. Plus, we talked about the Alfa Romeo partnership earlier. So There's definitely some good headwinds here. I will say, like, Kick is doing better than I thought they'd be doing at this point in the year, Pete. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, kind of similar. It all comes down to the fact that it's funded by gambling, though, doesn't it, at the end of the day, and where people's ethics lie in terms of that. So, yeah, I mean, we'll see. From my personal opinion, if these big streamers leave, they have a very young audience. So that, to me, seems incredibly predatory by Kick if they're, you know, trying to get a younger... There's no chance that Kick don't know the kind of streamers and the kind of viewership that they bring across to a platform. We've talked about how YouTube has been very tactical about these sort of brand-friendly streamers that they've signed to their platform. People like Courage, Valkyrie, Tim the Tap Man, you know, countless examples, Ludwig, of people that can go outside of just streaming content and be more mainstream and more popular. So this seems like a very different category that Kick.com are potentially chasing. But I don't know if it's so much Kick chasing them as it is, you know, Twitch and YouTube having restrictions that apparently don't exist on Kick. But I'm sure they will if they get big enough. Yeah. One thing just to mention quickly, I know it's going back a bit of news, but Teched Out said Ludwig tweeted at Neil asking for an interview for his podcast, and it seems like it will be happening. So that would be really interesting if we get the new CEO of YouTube also on a live stream podcast where, you know, all kinds of questions get asked. I want this to be as interactive of a show as possible. So trying to pull in some comments when we can, when we see little tidbits like that. So thanks for sharing that with us, Teched Out.
Yeah, speaking of that, I mean, kind of on this discussion we're already having, crazy Mr. Pips was asking, do you think it's worth starting on Kick right now? Which is maybe an option. I will tell you, I went ahead and got my usernames on Kick just as a very early precaution. I do not have any plans to stream there yet, but I think that's always a good idea just in case a platform blows up and you want to have that option. One addition to this that came out recently was some more details on the creator program for Kick, Which the big one we knew about was that it's going to be 95-5 sub split for creators, which Trainwreck has talked a lot about. But in addition to that, he said it's going to be 100% of on-site non-third-party donations. That's his verbatim wording, which is very strange wording to me, Pete. What they're trying to say basically is you'll apparently get all of the donation. If someone donates to you on the site, then it all goes straight to you. The platform is not going to take any cut of that, which is different than how Twitch or YouTube do things or have kind of teased they want to do things in the future. So in addition to that, the really interesting thing is they have the big part of the creator program is he said they want to pay people based on the hours they stream. So it sounds like they want to do a kind of a flat pay rate based on the numbers of hours you stream, a flat rate based on Kick's advertising CPMs, the average viewers you have, and then viewer demographics and engagement. So that's kind of like a formula they calculate. And then theoretically you get a flat paycheck based on those four things and what the the multiplication result, the sum. I don't know what the word is that comes out of that. So I haven't seen that in practice yet, but that's definitely a new concept that I don't think we've seen, besides maybe kind of the ads incentive program, Pete. That's the closest thing I can think of on Twitch. But this is a really interesting concept, and I kind of wonder if it comes out and it's sustainable. We'll have to see, but I thought that was interesting to mention.
Yeah, to me, it sounds like a complicated program when really what they actually want to do is just have a revenue share. Like a revenue share just solves all of these problems, because the more number of hours you stream, the more ads you can run, which works with a revenue share. There's a rate, which is based on how much an advertiser pays, and then you're sharing that revenue. The average viewers you have is increased with the number, you know, if you have an increased number of viewers, you're going to have an increased number of ads served. And then viewer demographics and engagement, that's something that's already taken into account by places like YouTube and Twitch. So they probably just don't have anywhere near enough data to actually start to serve ads, and they probably don't have enough advertisers that want to work with them, you know, unless you're wanting to buy a new Alfa Romeo Formula One car. That's the only one we've seen that have really partnered with them. But these shared details are interesting, and they're meant to look appealing. But until we actually know like what this looks like in terms of comparing it to Twitch, then I think it's just a lot of hot air, to be honest. I'd be surprised that if it was even comparable to Twitch's ad program, which a lot of people complain about not being, you know, the pay that they expect for streaming to such a large number of viewers. And maybe there's an expectation problem there. I kind of feel the same way about YouTube Shorts. Like a lot of people are disappointed at the rates that they're getting for YouTube Shorts. But at the end of the day, that's what's great about a revenue share, is because if it's seen to be popular and more advertisers come on board, a revenue share is the best outcome for creators, because as that increased revenue comes in, you're getting a share of that rather than some made up number, which may be the case here with the creator program.
Yeah. So we'll kind of see how it breaks down. I guess what they mentioned in the post, what Trainwreck's mentioned, is this is kind of until ads take over. So I guess they're kind of building out their ads program for Kick. So we'll see. And the other thing I'd mention is there have been a lot of wild claims about what you can and can't do on Kick. I think Aiden Ross was literally streaming the Super Bowl on Kick during that and saying that he could do that, and that was fine. So just be careful. There's a lot of misinformation about what you can and can't do on Kick, and you're definitely still beholden to copyright stuff. So don't go stream just whatever you want, basically, on Kick if you're going to try it out.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter what platform comes out and what you see other people do. This is exactly what happened to YouTube like 10 years ago and Twitch like 3 years ago. Once the platform becomes popular enough, the companies that own the copyright to these music labels or videos or sporting events, they will know about it. And then the company will have to comply, because it is literally copyright law. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if Kick got served with some pretty hefty fines or you know, takedown requests for streaming the Super Bowl, because I imagine the people that pay for the broadcasting rights of that want to keep it that way rather than having people watch it for free on the internet on a platform like Kick. Is that it for Kick news, Ben? In which case, I think we're on to Twitch, and you can take us through the first bit of Twitch news.
Yep. We're going to wrap things up with Twitch as this sort of the finale, as usual, I think, Pete. Lots of changes to talk about this week, and then one or two stories as well. I think we'll start with kind of what is the topic of this of the podcast here. And that is that Twitch has been getting a little bit of flack for exaggerating its popularity, specifically on the Crown Gaming channel. And there's a Bloomberg article that came out, I think some other articles as well, that kind of went into a dive about how the Crown channel, which is Twitch's kind of owned channel they use for promotions and partnerships, has been overreporting how many people are actually watching the broadcasts and engaging and things like that, because it's showing on the homepage carousel. And if anybody has had their channel on that carousel before or on those placements, you know there's a lot of just kind of viewer bloat if you're there, because your stream is being shown to people who are on the site but not actually watching it. They're kind of like using that as a page to get to somewhere else. The same way that when your stream gets embedded on sites, sometimes your viewer count goes way up, but your chat activity doesn't really change because it's just kind of people browsing the site and not watching the stream. And so it seems like people have kind of caught on to that, and brands have caught on to that, specifically for these partnerships that they're running. And so now they're kind of in the news with some heat for that, which I think is fair to a degree. This Bloomberg article is pretty long, Pete, and goes into some of the pitch decks that were in there and kind of what Twitch put in the pitch decks was not really what advertisers could expect to get, and calling them junk views in a way, which again, I think is fair if you're an advertiser and you're expecting this amount of engagement for something, and then maybe there's that view count there, but then no one's really engaging in the chat or with your activity, then you might be a little concerned. So just interesting to see it come out in the news, Pete. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of surprised me that it's taken this long for somebody to complain about this. And I guess it's not really a complaint until you take a look at the fact that Twitch was using it in their pitch deck of, you know, if you advertise with our Crown channel, then this is the number of views that you can expect to see. And then they were already always front paging that channel. There's certainly a lot of channels that get front page that soar massively in viewership. And then if they're not on the front page the next day, then you can see their like kind of true viewership. I've been front paged once when I live streamed myself running the Manchester Marathon. I think I was only front paged in the UK and not in the US, but it certainly massively boosted the number of people watching. I got a lot of people that had never seen any of my content watching something kind of unique. But actually, this has made me think about how sort of retro it feels to have a video carousel live playing when you tune into a website. Like, most websites have gone away from things auto playing, and certainly things like a carousel in the past sort of 3 or 4 years. You know, if you go to YouTube or something, you don't start seeing the first recommended video playing for you. But I guess with platforms like TikTok, you technically are. You're straight into content being watched, aren't you? So it surprises me that it affects it as much as it does, because I imagine most people don't go to Twitch and start watching video on the homepage. But that's kind of where the problem is. It's the people that are sort of browsing, and the Twitch player is still playing at the same time. And that's why it's sort of a fake view account, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the difference with TikTok too is that on TikTok, the entire phone screen is the ad, right? Like, that's all you can see when you go into the app, versus on Twitch, if you're on desktop, for example, you'll have the carousel or a video player at the top, but then all the other channels in the bottom, and you're kind of not really paying. I barely ever pay attention to the carousel if I'm going through the nav. And I have to think that a lot of people do the same thing on Twitch. So even the advertisers are paying for these impressions, but in a lot of cases, I think viewers aren't even seeing the video there. So they're kind of like a meaningless impression in a way. Now, I think there's some value to say that you can sort impressions versus engagement if you're an advertiser. And maybe like you'd be looking for a certain number of chat messages versus just displays and views. That's very typical in the advertising world. But I do think this is a fair kind of crackdown in a way on Twitch, because most brands, if they're smart, don't really care about just impressions. They want to have people who are actually involved and engaged in the broadcast. So I feel like Twitch will move away from just saying, look how many views that we had, look how many hours watched we had, versus here's how many chat messages we had, here's how many people, unique viewers, things like that. So I think that'll be good for the industry overall.
Talking of Twitch viewerships, Hogwarts Legacy. Now, this has been a controversial game from back right when it's been developed, and there's plenty of reasons for that. We're not going to dive into that in this podcast, but in terms of actual news based on this game, it broke the record for the most viewed single player game for peak concurrent viewership on Twitch, and this was before the game was even released, right? So I think Hogwarts Legacy and whoever the studio behind that is have worked alongside Twitch and come up with a pretty good strategy in terms of generating a lot of hype behind the game. I think drops were enabled, and they worked with select influencers to give them license to play and stream the game before it was actually officially released. But in terms of numbers, peak viewers, 1.3 million watching the Hogwarts Legacy game across a variety of different streams. I think XQC held a lot of that viewership, but that beats Cyberpunk, 1.1 million, and Elden Ring, 925,000 at their peaks, which I believe was release week as well. So, a game that's been met with a lot of controversy, some of it right, some of it wrong, in my opinion. But yeah, crazy to think of the amount of viewership that a game can get now, and how important it is for games to think about the release and how it can be, you know, increased. They can generate so much demand for the game just by seemingly working with Twitch, working with a few big streamers to make sure that they have exclusive access.
Yeah, I think drops too are such a huge part of games now, if they're smart about showing it on Twitch. They just, I mean, kind of similar to what we just talked about, Pete, honestly, they kind of inflate the view counts overall. And there's some question to how many of those views are legitimate, honestly, for people who just want to get the drops and getting them kind of with bots, maybe potentially just to get in-game items and things. But from a developer standpoint and a game standpoint, it's really good to have that metric to say, hey, look, we're the most watched game ever on Twitch because of this, beating out Elden Ring and Cyberpunk and these other games. And you can debate like whether that would have happened with or without drops, but it's still a great way to kind of show the success of your game and probably guarantee a sequel at this point, because even now I think it's like the 11th most watched game on Twitch currently. So I think it's kind of proven how drops can really just hyper accelerate the growth of your game if you're coming out with a new one on Twitch.
Let's move on from talking about the Hogwarts Legacy, talking about some of the features that have come out from Twitch this week. First things first, the viewer engagement panel. I think this is probably a couple of weeks old now. We talked about it being tested. Zach Wussey now says that the rollout has gone out to all streamers, so you should have this in your dashboard, the ability to see all different kinds of stats, chat messages, average viewers, live viewers, chatters, clips created, new followers, new subscriptions, ad breaks, and clip views as a timeline across your stream, and that should be in the stream summary page, I believe. We've also seen that Twitch has announced that you can now tag other channels in your stream title, and that generates a nice little clickable interface. And Ben was kind enough to test this for us. So people watching along with the live stream or watching the VOD after the fact, you can see Ben titled a stream, podcast time with, and then tagged my channel. And that means that, did you click this or is this a hover over action?
That's a hover, yeah. So for those of you listening and not watching, if you hover over the name in the title, it pops up a little card with, in this case, Pete's channel, his bio, how many followers he has, and then links to each of his socials, which this is actually a really cool change, I think, Pete. The fact they have all this kind of in the hover state is really interesting and maybe the first good use of the bio and socials that I've seen on Twitch. So this is a kind of a cool change.
And I zoned out for a second then, but there's also a button where you can then follow that channel without having to actually leave the stream that you're currently on, right? So you can click that love heart icon and actually be able to follow the channel. So it should help with collaboration, which is such a big part of growing a stream on Twitch. So yeah, now if you're streaming with somebody else who's also live or somebody who's not live, you can tag them and your viewers can see where to follow their channel on Twitch as well. And also just to share actually how you do that, Twitch did share how you do that. So you use the at symbol and then the channel name. So just the same as how you would tag somebody on Twitter or now on YouTube as well. It seems to be pretty consistent across the board. What else have we got, Ben? Do you want to take us through channel skins, maybe the next one?
Yeah. So this is something that we talked about in the sort of year roadmap that Twitch put out earlier this year. Channel skins are now in testing from what Twitch has said. And I think they've only done it with one channel so far, Pete, which was for Soda Poppin'. Basically, what channel skins are is an overlay on the channel, and there's a picture here which will make it better if you're able to see the picture to understand this, but it's a little card that shows over your chat if you're on desktop, as well as a pop-up card banner, kind of like the lower thirds that you might have seen on Twitch in the past, that just shows underneath your video, and it's kind of like your channel logo times sponsor. And the idea, I believe, is that Twitch wants to use to sell these to sponsors to kind of lay onto certain channels in a more engaging and interactive way than advertising has been so far. So to my knowledge, this is the only test I've seen so far. In this case, it was Soda Poppin' and Starforge, which is part of that whole network for PCs. And there's like a little CTA at the very bottom of the video player that links out, I would guess, to the actual website to go look at PCs. Same thing for right above the chat. And those are the two main call to actions that I can see, plus a little channel sponsor text in the bottom right of the video player. So it's pretty clear in those three placements that there's a sponsorship going on. I think this is kind of cool. This one's interesting because I believe Soda's actually involved with the brand. So it's a very natural collab. I wonder if we'll see, you know, Coca-Cola or like random big ads on here, or if this would be more saved for unique sponsorships. So we'll kind of have to see how it rolls out, but it's very much in beta for right now, Pete.
Is this more intrusive or less intrusive than you thought it would be when you first saw the sort of text description of streamers being able to work directly with sponsors through Twitch and sort of rebranding elements of their page around their stream? Because in my opinion, I thought it was, I think I described on the podcast that it was going to feel like we're going back to the 90s websites where you'd have like a full display ad behind the Twitch player and you sort of have, you know, G Fuel massive writing down the side of each side of the stream. So to me, this sort of seems less intrusive than I thought it would be. It does already annoy me that the Twitch video isn't taking up the full window because it's sort of shrunken so that it can show this sort of sponsor message at the bottom. But in some ways, honestly, maybe this is just the fact that I've been so tainted from the internet, but it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. It kind of looks fine in some ways, but I imagine some streamers probably aren't going to use it just because it's a slightly worse viewer experience. So maybe they'll just, you know, do undisclosed channel sponsors rather than this way, which is nice and clearly disclosed that you're working with a sponsor.
Yeah, so I kind of agree with you in the way that I thought it'd be more of the full page experience. And I also wonder how this looks on mobile, honestly, because this is very much a desktop view that we have here. I do think the worst part of it is that it shrinks the video of the stream. If they could just adjust that so that you still get a full size video player, but still have the overlays, I think that would solve a lot of the issues. I kind of like this overall, though, because it makes it really, really clear that it's a partnership. And I think if you do it with a brand you're really interested in, then it could be kind of cool for viewers to come in and see, hey, you know, this brand's working with the streamer I really like. And it's a very kind of exciting connection versus just some random ad thrown onto your channel that you may or may not have any interest in. So I like the idea. I think it's maybe a little overboard on the execution, specifically on shrinking the video. And then they've kind of got like two things overlaid on top of the video right now. So that might be a little much. I think they should probably, since this is a test still, Pete, hopefully they can change it so that it doesn't cover so much of the video and more of just having things around the video. I think that might make it better, but we'll kind of have to wait and see.
There's two things I want to know. I want to know, firstly, what happens when you click on one of these elements? I presume it just opens up a new tab and goes to sort of whatever link, in this example, Starforge PCs have worked on with Twitch. But it'd be cool if it sort of, you know, opened a little pop-up in the middle and talked about Soda Poppin's relationship with or something like that. But I'm probably asking too much. The second thing, maybe more interestingly, you can see in this screenshot, a hype train is close. He's only one one stage away from getting a hype train. What happens when a hype train happens at the same time? Because the sort of stream chat ad banner is in place of where a hype train goes. So Twitch has got to prioritize. You know, do you want the money from the advertiser or do you want to promote the scam train? The hype train.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I assume they want to have both. It looks like they've got a smaller, like the drop down plus the banner. So I guess they could probably do both, but that's a good point. When you're building things like this, there's so many pieces to Twitch now that I'm sure they have to take all this into consideration for how it changes. And they have said it's a test, so I hope they change things up and kind of take some of the feedback, because I think this has a lot of potential. They just have to kind of get it right. So hopefully they get there.
All right, last piece of news to talk about is that TwitchCon has officially been announced, both the European and the American versions. Again, this is maybe a week old news, but a lot of people might not have seen the tweets or heard the announcement. So the dates for TwitchCon EU is the 8th to the 9th of July this year, and it's happening in Paris. I think that was all already known. I knew some people had already booked hotels. And then there was a leak, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago about the American one, and people were discussing, is it going to be true? Is Twitch actually going to have TwitchCon in Las Vegas the same year that they sort of reduced gambling on Twitch? They're going to have it in the capital of gambling itself. That is the 20th to the 22nd of October. So kind of the same sort of time periods that they usually have. They usually have the EU one in the sort of April, May, June. So it's a slightly bit later in July. And then the American one's always been sort of late in the year, yep. September, October. So are you gonna be able to go to the October one? I mean, you're going to have a 6-month-old kid, hopefully, aren't you? So
Babies, so we'll see. But what about you and Paris, Pete? Any thought of that one?
Unfortunately, that falls right on my honeymoon. So no, won't be making it. I don't think I'll make either of them this year. but I do want to go back to them. So I went to quite a few back when Gaming Careers was first growing. I went to the American one, I think 2 or 3 years in a row, and loved it. Exhausting traveling from the UK for like a three-day convention. I usually try to make a week out of it and see some people whilst I was out there. But it's always good fun. You always come back super motivated. So if you do have the opportunity to go, or if you are going, then make sure you link up. We'll have a channel in the Gaming Careers Discord where you can sort of find other people from the Gaming Careers community that are going to TwitchCon, and you can meet up. But I've met so many community members and had such a great time at TwitchCon, so I definitely will go back to them once I can. My priority actually is probably to go to the American one so that me and you can finally meet in real life, because it's a travesty that relationship hasn't developed
years now, Pete.
Over the internet. I know, it really is bad. So yeah, let us know in chat if you're heading to either of the Twitch cons. And it's good to see that they're still doing both the European one and the American one. So hopefully next year we'll be able to make some of those. But I believe that is it for the topics this week. Quite a lot that we've recapped. So lots of Twitch updates, the Kick program, creator program, and some streamers moving over to it. YouTube replying with shorts to comments, and Susan stepping down as CEO. Twitter, a whole host of changes, 4,000 character tweets, two-factor authentication changes, and the pay-to-checkmark being copied by Meta. One thing we didn't mention, actually, we've got right at the start of our show notes here, and we didn't cover it at all, but worth noting, if you are ever in the position to run a charity stream, such as what happened, I think, last week, where we had Hassan, didn't we, who's raising money for the earthquake relief in Turkey. He was using a charity platform called SoftGiving, and some news has come out about SoftGiving. So if you were planning on using them to make a charity stream, you probably shouldn't, because it turns out that they take 50% of the donations commission and then a 4% processing fee on top of that. So I don't know if they necessarily do take that, but in their contract it says that they can take that. So I don't know how much money Hassan actually ended up raising, but I think it was $1 million maybe, or something, 200,000. A significant amount of money anyway. If they're taking half of that, there are plenty of actually good charity platforms. Twitch has built its own one now, so use that if your charity is supported on Twitch's charity tool, I think it's called. There's platforms like Tiltify, Just Giving. These aren't scummy charity platforms where they actually give your full donation or people's full donation to the charity rather than taking huge amounts of the commission. So just worth pointing that out. It's not really, I don't like covering news that's so negative, but I know a lot of people do charity streams time to time. I was just talking earlier in this podcast about my marathon live stream, which I did and raised money for charity. And there are plenty of good platforms out there to use. So I don't want to end on a negative note, Ben. Give us something to look forward to this next week. What have we got to look forward to?
We'll see. I mean, hopefully we'll get some more of the updates that Twitch mentioned. I'm still waiting for news on the TikTok feature, Pete, because I don't think it'll come till end of year, but you never know. Maybe they'll get it out earlier. We have seen a couple things. We got channel skins shown. We've got tagging channels. Those are some good changes. So hopefully we'll have some more of those things that Twitch promised coming soon. And maybe, I guess, having the new head of YouTube on the podcast with Ludwig, because if that happens, I'm sure we'll get some good insight into what his kind of thoughts are for the next year or so. So that'd be cool.
Speaking of podcasts, anybody listening to the audio of this podcast, please do leave us a review and a rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you do. If you can leave like a thumbs up or a star rating, it does help the show grow into new recommendations for other people. Maybe we can grow to the heights where we can have the YouTube CEO on our podcast, where we can ask the real hard-hitting questions, not like Ludwig with his podcast. No, honestly, but really grateful for anyone that's left us a review before. We do read them all, so thanks so much for checking out the podcast. And the people that have watched live, as always, thank you for being here. We had some good comments that we pulled in to the live stream today, and people watching the video after the fact, why not watch this live? We do it every single Monday, GMT 9 till 10 p.m., EST 4 till 5 p.m., is that right, Ben?
Yes.
And then I don't know what is West Coast, but you guys can work out. There's a countdown on the Gaming Careers website. If you go to gamingcareers.com/podcast, where you can see all the previous episodes of the podcast, there is also a countdown at the top to the next podcast. So you can just go there if you don't live in one of those time zones. Anyway, I'm just rambling now. We'll catch you in the next one, guys. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. See you later. Peace.
See ya.